everybody. Welcome to Mostly Muskies podcast. Larry Ramsall and Steve Worrell, a couple of old guys talking muskies. We're going to have this podcast as a regular feature on Rural Republic, which is a network coming up, and Outdoors First Media. Larry, welcome aboard.
Thank you, sir.
This is going to be a lot of fun. Larry and I have known each other for a very, very long time. I'd like to get Larry introduced for anybody that, for somehow, if you're in the musky world and you haven't been introduced to Larry one way or another, you've either been living under a rock or something. But Larry is a preeminent historian for muskies, recognized throughout the world as authority on musky history, and a pretty damn good fisherman, for that matter. Has caught a few giants.
I need to catch one now and then.
Pardon me?
I managed to catch one now and then.
We all, you know, even a blind squirrel, right?
Yes.
But tell me a little bit, Larry, how you got, first of all, into the sport.
Well, my dad took me when I was about knee high to a tall Indian, and the bug hit hard. Took me three years of short trips to hooked my first legal, and that was the end, as they say. It's been muskies pretty much my whole life ever since.
Yeah, it's addicting once you get introduced to it. Either it gets you or it doesn't. And most of the time, if you're an angler already and somebody that is adept at the sport introduces you to it, you're pretty well done once you catch one.
Yeah, that's strange how that works. It affected me, affected my mom. Affected my dad, obviously, but my brother had no interest in the fish. My son has no interest in the fish, but my daughter's avid. So you just never know who it's going to bite.
Exactly. Well, a little bit about me and how I got into this. I was a bass fisherman in Illinois as a kid, and fished Bangs Lake and all the lakes in that area, and what used to be known as the Northwest Suburbs, and is now actually part of Chicago for all intents and purposes. My dad started taking me up to a resort in your area on Moose, and caught a couple of walleyes, and we weren't fishing muskies, but I saw one, and it kind of messed me up. So I was about 15, 16, and he took me up to Bone Lake, and we fished jigs, which was a very odd way to catch muskies back then. And, you know, all of the fancy plastics didn't exist back then. It was called a squirming jig, and it was a worm, literally a night crawler, very bad copy, and a large jig that weighed probably half an ounce. And I just decided that's how I was going to fish muskies up there, because we didn't know any better. And the first one I caught was about 25 pounds, and that wrecked me. That was it. We were in a
Yeah,
14-foot Alumacraft with a 6-horse outboard, real fancy ride, right?
Yeah. I caught my first two legals on the old Pfluger Globe, the Yellowbird.
Oh boy, that's a classic.
Yeah. Still have one hanging on my wall here.
Highly sought after collector's lure if they're new too.
Yeah, they're getting harder and harder to find, that's for sure.
So I'm curious. It takes a lot of work to be a dedicated historian, probably way more than most people would ever grasp. But it's hours and hours and hours of research, and telephone calls, and letters before computers were around. And you did a lot of this long before computer technology and that kind of stuff was readily available. Trips all over the place, wherever muskies are. I mean, you've been around the musky world investigating big fish, investigating possible hoaxes, which is another podcast that we're going to have a lot of fun with.
Yes.
I can't wait for that one. I haven't had the folks over in Hayward pissed at me for quite a while, so we might as well fire that back up again. it's interesting to me that someone who fishes muskies as much as you do would take that on to become a historian, with the time that it takes. I mean, it obviously pretty much enveloped a large portion of your life. How in the world did you start becoming a preeminent historian? You're a great writer, by the way.
Thank you.
Do you have classical training in writing, or did you just write as a matter of talent?
Not just naturally, I think. In fact, one of my English teachers in high school made a comment about it. But I started back in the 50s when I first started fishing. There were no musk clubs. There were no musky magazines. There were no musky websites. There wasn't even a website. So whenever a magazine would hit the newsstand that had a musky article,
oops, froze up. Can you hear me, Larry? Rejoin me, buddy. Altogether, he uses having here.
Back.
Yeah.
Technology at its finest again, huh?
No, we're gonna have burps. It's the way it is. We just rough through it. We're tough old birds. Just start again with, I can patch all this together. It's recorded as a video, so I can edit all of it, so it doesn't, well, nobody will even know we dropped off. So just start again.
We're in the middle of my book collection. At one point I had 550 books. It was either all about muskie or had something in it about muskies. And every muskie article that was ever published, probably from the 50s through, I would say probably the 80s or 90s before I got inundated and finally quit that madness, because there was beginning to be so much. I've got every magazine that Muskies Inc.'s ever published. I've got every magazine that Ski Hunter published. It's just been it's been an obsession, I guess you could call it. Everything I could get my hands on, I read it, including scientific literature. I followed that as closely as I did popular angling articles, and amassed quite a library over the years.
Well, it's the task to put it all together into compendiums. What brought you to write the books? That's, a lot of that history would have been lost. All of it, in fact, would have been lost. And a lot of it, quite frankly, would have been modified to fit whatever myth happened to be surrounding some of those larger fish. And there were a lot of myths that, I understand that. It's the old plaid shirt deal back in the 30s, 40s, 20s, 30s, 40s. And you slapped on a plaid shirt and grew a little hair on your face and got in a boat and called yourself a muskie guide. And some of them were good at it, and some of them were really good at actually spreading a lot of bull. But a lot of that would have been
probably more of that than there was the real.
Great stories. I mean, the story sounded really cool, and there's been books, a lot of them written about their stories, unfortunately perpetuating myths. But a lot of that would have been gone. And as it is, it's all there. It's all recoverable. It's in the compendiums. It's wherever that you have posted it, across the internet, Muskie First, and a whole lot of other sites over the years. Too bad some of them went away. Some of those message boards had some really valuable conversation on them, and they just disappeared. But thankfully, you took the time to put it all together. So, folks, if you haven't read Larry's compendiums or his book with the postcards, that's just cool. And if you're a Muskie fan, you got to take a look at that just because it's cool. But if you haven't read them, you need to understand why we are where we are now, how we got here, and how muskie fishing went from what it was back in, whatever it was, to date. So let's talk a little bit about that, Larry. How did this all start? The muskies in the central part of the United States, eastern part of the United States, all pretty much came from flowages after the Ice Age. 10,000 years ago it started, correct?
Yeah, it's interesting history. I started writing a lot of small piecemeal articles for the Muskies Inc. newsletter, which became a magazine. And I was world record secretary for the Fishing Hall of Fame. I was representative for the National Game Fish Association. And I was down in Fort Lauderdale at the IGFA headquarters with Ken Schultz, the associate fishing editor of Field and Stream. And after our meeting at IGFA, which was the purpose was to try to merge the two world record programs. Ken and I had supper, and later in our room, he said, "Why don't you write a book?" And I said, "Well, that's for guys like you." But he planted the seed, and it was in the winter. It was in January, and so when I got back home, I didn't have a lot going on at that time. So I started pulling my files together, and that all ended up being volume one, which is published in, the first compendium published in 1982 by my good friend Al Scar, who also published Muskie Magazine. And then I continued to follow up on legends and hoaxes and wild stories and actual giant catches, and did a second edition in 97 or 98, Muskie Hunter published that one, and thought maybe that would be it. But then in 2006, the world record controversies came to a head in the early 90s. John Detloff had successfully got the IGFA in the Hall of Fame to set aside the Lawton world record, unfoundedly, as my subsequent research found out. And so after a protest of the spray record by the World Record Muskie Alliance was denied by the Hall of Fame, I thought, they're playing politics. They're covering their behind, looking basically at tourism for this area rather than doing the right thing, because they didn't follow the same criteria with the Lawton fish as they did with the spray fish, or vice versa. And so they upheld the spray fish when there was a lot more evidence of it being illegitimate than there ever was against the Lawton fish. And so I dug out my files again, and I sat down and spent 3 months, 18 hours a day, 7 days a week, putting together volume one of my third edition, which is strictly about the world records and all the controversies. And then I spent another month, same amount of time, putting together volume two of the third edition, which covered everything else, the fun stuff, as I call it. You know, the could have beens, the should have beens, the might have beens, the legends and the hoaxes, release, hybrids, and so forth and so on. So in total, there's about 1,350 pages and over 700 historic photographs in those two volumes, which probably will be the last edition of the compendium, because there's just, and everything is catch and release today, and it's impossible to verify, and you know, a lot of giant fish being caught, but unless they're hung on a scale, you really don't know how much they weigh. So formulas can get you really close, but there's nothing like putting them on a scale to weigh them and getting an accurate weight.
Right.
So that's what brought it to where it's at. And, you know, I still, chairman of the Muskie Musculins World Record Program Committee, and we have a very legit modern record that people can hang their hat on. There's with the rules that we have in place, and you can find out about this on modernmuskierecords.org, muskie spelled with IE, on the website. And anyway, our current modern day record is 58 pounds. It took seven years to get a fish of that caliber that could be verified. And since that was to 2013, it's still holding. If there's been any bigger than that caught, they've been released, because nobody's hung one on a scale that's bigger than that. So that pretty much follows my conclusion for many, many years that maybe 61, 62 pounds they can get to, but nobody is, to my satisfaction, hung one on the scale bigger than 61 and a quarter pounds that has ever been verified.
Now that's, you know, the whole idea that a 70 pound muskie needs to be the one that we're going to break. You know, for my entire youth, that's what I thought had to happen. And I spent 20 years traveling Northwest Ontario, where, you know, we didn't have the kind of musky fishing, the big fish numbers that we have now, for a number of reasons. You know, that's something we'll be talking about in great detail in further episodes. But we didn't have the kind of musky fishing we have now then. Now, it was good fishing. But if you wanted to experience what we're seeing in Green Bay and St. Clair and things like that, and at some of the lakes in Minnesota, you wanted to experience that, you had to go to Northwest Ontario or, you know, Northeast Canada, some place where muskies naturally did what muskies can do, unpressured, unfettered, with all kinds of overstocking, etc. And so, you know, for a while there, as a young man, I was chasing them in Manaki and all over parts of the Goon and Lake of the Woods, and, you know, I mean, Crow and pick a bunch, you know, they're just lots and lots of trips up there. And I never honestly worked hard at it, and I never saw a fish much bigger than the one I caught on Wabagoon, and that might have clipped 50 pounds. And, you know, talking with the gentleman up there, they used to come to my cabin and stop by and talk to me when they were doing surveys on the lake when I was at Indian Point. I was usually the only guy in there. So they'd stop by and talk to the crew that was in the boat. And it seemed some really big fish, but they weren't willing to say 70 pounds either. You know, I haven't found anybody in the know that's willing to say that. And yet, for one reason or another, the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources insists on hanging on to that as a legitimate record, which is bizarre. It is the way it is. But, you know, people come into the sport expecting that to happen, and it's not going to. How many years has it been since that 58?
This will be the eighth year now.
Yeah,
it's in 2013 when it was gone.
And so many more muskie fishermen in the sport, uncounted, just it's exploded. Yeah,
it's exponential. The equipment's much better. There's boats are much better, faster, bigger. It's just crazy. And if with the exponentially that many more really good muskie fishermen out there chasing these fish, if those super fish existed, they would have caught one by now.
Somebody would have put one in the boat.
Exactly.
You know, I've seen some giants in my life, but a giant to me is a mid 50 pound fish. And you know, that put the fire out in me a little bit to get that one on Wabagoon back in 95, because I realized by then that I might have been chasing a ghost. You know, to me, it just seemed like I was chasing something that didn't exist, a myth.
Well, that's what it all is. You know, our generation was of the belief that, 70 pounds is what took to beat the record. And if they don't get that big, you're never going to catch one that big. You know, especially with the scrutiny of today.
Oh, yeah.
Back in the old days, communication was so slow. Things weren't pursued for accuracy like they are today. You catch a big fish and claim it today, you better be able to back it up.
Yep.
And, we're talking pictures, video, DNR certification, or, World Record Committee certification. There was so many ways that people could cheat back in the day to get a world record that, Louis Spray figured that out and took advantage of it three different times. So but it's still part of our history, and it probably created a lot of fishermen got that big. But in reality, anybody chasing, and we could take that one step further. I don't know what your belief is, but I think there's basically two different subspecies or species or whatever you want to call them, muskies, and some of them get big and some of them don't. And like I've told people for years in my seminars, that if the lake you're fishing, the lake record is 33 pounds, guess what? You're not going to catch a world record there. In other words, to catch even a 60-pound muskie, if in fact they get that big, which a few probably do, then you better be fishing where the genetics allow them to get that big. And the water, in most cases, has to be big enough to protect that fish for 25 years or so to allow it to grow that big. So lots of complicating factors, but the first one being genetics and availability of a fish to grow that size in a water body that you're fishing.
That's been pretty much the mantra that I've been using for now, ever since that controversy came out, and I discovered that my beliefs were based upon a really great story, from back in the day. And I kind of got sucked into it a little bit just before it actually happened. Interestingly, you ever hear of a guy named Gabby Ball?
What's that?
Gabby Ball. His name is Gabby Ball. He was a guy from Elko a number of years ago. All my phones are ringing. A guy from Elko a number of years ago, back in the 70s, that I met. He was already elderly at the time. And he was the one who had that picture of the fish that was speared out of Enterprise. That was
okay. Yeah, it's in my book.
Yep. And he showed me that picture. Gabby and I got to be friends. He was a renegade. I mean, the guy was famous for doing whatever was illegal in fishing. He was good at it. And that was a really big fish. I mean, there's no question it was a really big fish, but it was a, 50 pounder, right? And I looked at that and thought, man, that thing is huge. I had the photograph in my hands, the original. And I looked at it and went, that is a monster. It's an absolute monster. And it's a 50-some pounder. And that started to plant the seed like, oh, something's really wrong here. So I decided that instead of setting my goal, you know, I was kind of insane. I was chasing big fish. If I heard, you know, I went to Manaki before there was a decent road, wrecked my rig going up there a couple of times. When you got there, the first thing they told you in town, which was tiny, is don't go to Rosie's. And the second thing they told you is don't expect the culture up here to be what you think. And it was really a protected area. They had their own sociological makeup up there. And
yeah, bet.
You got a t-shirt when you got there. You could buy a t-shirt that said, I made it to Manaki, because the road was so bad. And, I fished that hard. The reason I went up there is Al Smith, the taxidermy up in Boulder Junction, was a friend of mine. And he had a couple of hybrids in that came into his shop that were true 30-pound hybrids, which are rare beasts. And he had a couple of really big trues that were mid-40-pound class. I mean, giants. And the guys that caught them were from Appleton, and they said nothing to no one. So I thought, well, I got to go do that. And I went up there and fished hard and caught a few really nice fish. But I fished really hard, spent a lot of money, wrecked my boat twice, where I had to have the gel coat all repaired and fix my trailer. And the net result was fish that were as big as the ones that Al Smith was getting at that day. There weren't any giants up there. They're, you know, not what I thought was going to be a giant. Then the Lake of the Woods really hit off. I went there, and I mean, pick a body of water where it made the press at all. And I hunted it down and went fishing there. And then I looked at a lot of them that didn't. Tried, you know, fishing all around Dryden on some of the other lakes other than Wabagoon, et cetera, because there's some pretty good water there. And there's a lot of 48 to 50 inch fish in them. But, you know, 20 some years on the Goon, pounding it mercilessly, spending way more time there, which was not good for me, my family, or anything. But that's what musky crazed people do. And the net result was a couple of really big fish and one that I could confirm. You know, I caught another just like it, but it was a little lighter, just literally a few weeks later. But, you know, it's one of those deals where it just came to me suddenly that fish that I caught, I'm not going to get a bigger one. And I'm not. I don't have the access or the time to go up into northeastern Ontario where I got a shot. But even then, you know, how often is that going to happen in your lifetime? I mean, you work really hard. How many do you have, right? If the average kid that gets into this sport right now needs to know, starting out, that a 25-pound fish is really a very nice muscle lunch, and you need to
respect. Absolutely.
Yeah.
I can remember when I was a kid, my dad said he raised one that was 4 foot, and that stuck in my mind for years. I thought, what a monster, 4 foot muskie. But now the benchmark is 50 inches, and that's a nice muskie too. But now it seems like the new benchmark is 55, and who knows where it's going to end. But there's just so many more people fishing with intelligence and good equipment that these bigger fish are being caught. But there's still none being caught that beats 62 pounds. So
I don't think there ever is going to be one. I mean, I'd love to see it, but. You know, with all this history and all this time,
I would never say there can't be a freak. Yep. You know,
well,
I mean, it's possible, but
there's 500 pound people, so you just never know. But yeah,
I stood at the belt buckle of a guy that was 8'6", but you know, not too many of him running around.
Right, exactly. Talk about that technology a little bit. I work with Johnson Outdoors, or one of the folks that Outdoors First works with. And in my gear that I'm picking up this year, I'm picking up equipment that gives you what they call mega imaging 360 degrees around the boat. And this is being used right now. And mine just hasn't hit my front door yet. But it's being used right now. And you turn this on and turn your sonar on, Mega Imaging Sonar. Turn your 360 on, set how far you want to see. And that's usually about a casting distance for me, because or a little bit more. And it literally looks like radar on the screen, and it literally gives you an image 360 degrees around the boat, 60 feet away or more, of everything that's there in real time. And if there's a muskie there, it draws a sonar image, so there will be a bright spot and then a shadow behind it. And the shadow behind it is much clearer than the bright spot is, because it's dark on the screen, and it shows you a perfect image of a musk launch. Yeah. There's guys now doing nothing but using that 360, driving around until they see a muskie and fishing for it. And
I can't. Well, fish hadn't got a chance.
You would think not. And yet, you know, their success rate isn't any better than the guys that aren't using them, really. It's just that you know they're there. It isn't. Apparently, it's become evident that it doesn't do you a lot of good, unless you're really, really a good fisherman, to know the fish is there. You need to know how to get a lure in front of it. You need to know what lure that should be. You need to know how's the speed that it should be running under the given conditions. You need to know what might trigger that fish, and then you got to convert it. And so it's not as magical as it might seem, other than the fact that there's no way to hide anymore. And the fish can't hide from you. They just can't. I chased.
Well, you know, go back in our days before all this fancy equipment, even before depth finders. We had milk runs, and there's a reason we had milk runs, because we knew a good musky spot. We didn't know what was in the water there at the time we were there, but we would hit enough spots during the day that sooner or later we might find one that's got a fish on it that'll hit. Yep. And that, you know, the end result was we caught fish without all that fancy equipment. These guys today, if they're relying on this stuff to get them fish, they're missing a boat.
The whole concept, right. The gear is wonderful. Believe me, I love it. I utilize it every single day, and it'll teach you more than you could possibly believe. You know, a simple thing, this is not on subject, but a simple example. When I put the 360 on the boat of a lot of our clients are crappie companies, and I fish crappies a lot to create content for them. And I was out on Monaco Lake, which has some pretty decent crappies in it, up to 14, 15. And dropped that 360 in the water, first time I had used it. And my wife got about a 13 incher out of a school of fish. And it takes a while to get the fish in the boat, get the images taken, you know, do everything you got to do to get the content that I need and throw it back. And her immediate reaction, of course, logically, is throw back where you caught that fish, right? I looked on the 360, they were 30 feet away. Those fish got fins, and they use them. They don't just sit there. I couldn't believe how fast that school had moved.
Yeah.
And so I said, no, you got to cast over to the left about 30 feet, about 20 feet from the boat. She dropped that jig right in the middle of them, bam, got another one. And I chased that school around for a half an hour. You know what? We got three out of it. You see them, but I couldn't get the stupid things to do what I wanted them to do. However, that was like this light bulb going off, where I would think, you know, okay, Pelican Lake, Anagu Island, northwest corner of the rock bar, a little spire out there. There's two rocks that look like Volkswagens. They're so big. And I would think there's fish there. There's always a muskie there. Guess what? There's not. But every guide day, every time I was there, I would tell my clients, this is a great spot. This will hold a fish. And if we didn't see it, I assumed we didn't see it because we didn't do the right thing. And in actual fact, now that I have that equipment, I go there and look, fishing it. You know, I'm not just running around the lake, but I'm fishing that rock bar. And there's a fish somewhere along that bar almost every time, but it's not always there. So, yeah, this, you still have to know what to do, and you still have to fish.
Personally, I would rather not know.
Yeah.
Oh, you know, if you got the equipment and you see a fish and can't catch it, you're going to get complex. Whereas if you're fishing a good spot and you don't see one, you just think they aren't there. So you move on, that milk run situation again. But yeah, I, I don't use that equipment, and I don't have that equipment, and I don't want that equipment. That's I'd rather not know, and if I catch one, I know I earned it because I knew the spot rather than knew there was a fish there.
Yeah, that's frustrating at times. What was your first sonar? What kind of sonar did you start out with when they came out with them?
I built a Heath kit, which is the same as the early Lowrance green box.
Very familiar with it. That's same thing.
Used that for a number of years.
That's amazing. So, you had a Heath. You know how rare that is to talk to somebody who had a Heath kit? Now, even in our generation, there were very few people that were curious enough to build one of those. And my uncle, John Worrell, was in the Navy, and he was into electronics. So he actually built my dad a sonar before the Heath kit came out. And it was just a simple flasher. The technology existed. But as soon as that Heath kit came out, I had one in my hand. I was just a kid. But everywhere I went, I took that Heath kit with me. And
I couldn't afford to buy, fancy new Lowrance, so I built one.
Right. Well, then I moved on from the Heath kit when it finally, and it lasted a long time. That was a tough unit. I beat it up, and, you know, as a kid. And I finally moved on to a used blue box, I think. I had that for a while, and then went to the green box. And the next thing you know, we're looking at live images of fish underwater. Now these days, the crappie guys tell me if you don't have some form of live mega imaging so you can see the fish in front of you swimming around and pick out the one you want to try to catch, that you aren't going to win a crappie tournament. Without that equipment, you're not going to do it. So I guess whether you want to do that or not, the industry and fishing itself is stuck with it. That's what's going to be, I guess. Interesting though.
Well, the industry wants to make money, and the people want to catch fish, so if they think they have to have that stuff to catch fish, they'll buy it.
And limits and that kind of stuff now are adjusting to take care of that. I see a lot of lakes around here that hold good panfish are now a limit of 5 of each species, and that's something that had to happen for muskie too. I mean, we had to put the limit up there high enough to pretty much force the folks that didn't either believe in or hadn't heard of catch and release to let them go. And the resistance was terrible. I know when Norm and Mike and I worked on the 50-inch limit on Pelican, some of those meetings were quite contentious. The argument about little Johnny with his first 35, and we were going to break his heart and all that stuff. We got it done. And Pelican Lake has a lot more 40s and mid 40s and upper 40s than it's ever had. But guess what? It doesn't have a ton of 50s. It's got them, but it didn't just sprout 50-inch muskies. And that was the big fear. The entire anti-size limit group was saying, well, this is going to just be filled with these giant fish and they'll swim around eating everything. And in actual fact, the population balanced out nicely. And it's still stocked, or they wouldn't exist there. Unfortunately, there'd be very few. But what that did was it didn't create a bunch of 45-pound fish. What it created was a solid, steady hierarchy of year classes. And they survived the pressure because of angling mortality. You're going to lose a few, every year. So it did the job. But talk a little bit about that. How did we end up getting to a 50-inch limit? What do you think was the driving force behind that?
Well, there were so many fish being killed, and the increase in the number of muskie fishermen was multiplying so fast that a lot of people realized that it wasn't going to last if people kept killing everything they caught. I know when I first started fishing, if it was legal, we kept it. And, and the people who were worried about little Johnny today wouldn't dream of keeping a muskie.
No, he's proud to let it go.
It's just a process of education. And it's interesting. I was over in Michigan last week, and they've progressed to the point of you can only keep one muskie per year during the open season. They have an open season for harvesting, but you can only keep one a year. But you can fish the entire year around now in Michigan, catch and release, catch and immediate release, they call it CIR. which gives you the benefit of both worlds. There's a lot of people, like some of the guys on Lake St. Clair, don't agree so much with fishing during the spawn, but you know, obviously the DNR thinks that it's not going to hurt the fishery enough to make a difference, particularly in Lake St. Clair, where it's basically a fish factory. But the thing that I found most interesting was that, you know, even though they still allow spearing in Michigan, you can only have one a year, so that's going to protect that fishery forever.
You think that's something that ought to happen in the rest of the range, Minnesota, Wisconsin? I that sounds attractive to me.
Yeah, I don't think it could hurt, because there's still it's probably a fairly small percentage of people that still kill everything they catch. I know there used to be a guy around here that claimed to let them go, but people who knew better knew he was keeping most of what he caught. He fished with me once, and he caught one, and he let it go, but it probably broke his heart to have to do so.
Didn't want to incur your wrath, huh? Well, a lot of this came from, you know, the catch and release philosophy. A lot of it came from Muskies Inc. You know, I've been an active Muskies Inc. guy for a number of years. There were a few years there where some politics kept me out of it, but now I'm as of last year in June, I became the marketing and communications VP again with Muskies Inc. I've always believed solidly in the organization, and they've done a great job, I think, in getting the word out. How long have you been around the Muskies Inc. folks, and what do you know about how that got started?
Well, I joined in the mid-70s, Gil Ham. I ran into him, and, you know, you don't say no to Gil Ham.
He was the founder, so, right?
He was the founder. Founded in 66. I've been around a long time. I spent 2 years as international president, and still on the international board, I guess, if I would attend the meetings. But, yeah, they've grown way, way beyond. I know I'm back in the late 70s, I believe it was, one winter when I didn't have a lot going on, I jumped in the car and I made a winter trip out east, West Virginia to New York, up into Ontario, over to Michigan, down through Indiana, and signed up a whole bunch of new Muskies Inc. chapters to make the organization truly international and grow it into area outside of the immediate area of the founding in Minnesota. Because for a number of years, even the guys in Wisconsin here thought that was a Minnesota organization, and they didn't want to join and give their dues to something that was going to go to Minnesota. So we had to dispel the thought that it was purely a Minnesota organization. So we increased the number of chapters, but even at that, if you look at the magazine today, you got almost a full page listing of chapters all over the United States, actually from the state of Washington down into Colorado and Arizona and out east, North Carolina now, and West Virginia has always been on board, and just places you'd never dream of seeing a Muskies Inc. chapter now have viable, hardworking chapters, and they all do good.
And yeah, believe it or not, we just had one sign up from Maine. And, you know, Maine basically considers muskellunge pesky invaders. You know, there's not a lot of respect for the fish over there. As a result of that, a group of guys got together and set a chapter up. I just got their Facebook presence up. I believe it's chapter 77. But anyway, so we got one in Maine. And there's all kinds of great stuff going on inside Muskies Inc. Those chapters are doing heat mortality studies in association with several other organizations. They're combining efforts with some of the Canadian groups and lots of research going on. And all of that is funded by chapter members, obviously, and then money from the calendar, things like that. That's a great fundraiser. And the magazine is part of it as well to draw in people. But it's a great organization. Honestly, anybody that's out there that's a muskie fisherman that has not joined Muskies Inc. should, just because we all claim we're conservationists and we all defend the sport out on the water. Well, here's your chance to put your $50 where your mouth is. Make it happen.
Yeah, if you want more muskie, you got to protect the fishery, and you got to contribute to protecting the fishery. And, just our chapter here in Hayward is just shy of $500,000 over the last 20 plus years to the fishery right here in this area. And that doesn't count the money that we've given to the Gilham Fund Foundation. And this is just one chapter. And of course, now the Twin Cities chapter administers the Hugh Becker Foundation. Hugh was one of the founding board members of Muskies Inc. And they've spent over $2 million in projects all over the North American Muskie Range, Canada, Northeastern part of the United States. Anywhere there's muskies, they've provided funds for worthwhile projects that couldn't have happened without Muskies Inc.
Right. And so if you're listening to this podcast, you're a muskie fisherman, you haven't joined Muskies Inc., get to muskiesinc.org and sign up. It's inexpensive. You get a magazine quarterly. You get a calendar that's absolutely gorgeous. And you get the interaction with the group. There's some resistance. One of the reasons I took on my responsibilities there as a board member was to dispel the myth that Muskies Inc. is a good old boys club, and that you'll join it and they won't talk to you. That's not true at all. It might have been true 20 years ago to a degree where a new guy would have trouble, but that's because there were so few new guys, and it's human nature. Now there's we've picked up 9 million new anglers since the pandemic started. I would guess that a lot of them were guys that in the 80s their dad took them up to northern Minnesota or northern Wisconsin or over the Dakotas or wherever and fished, and they found themselves in a situation where they had the time and the resources to do that and re-entered the sport. Then there's the people that just thought it would be cool to try. So there's a ton of new anglers out there. And hopefully the new muskie fishermen embrace the history and embrace the conservation ethic. And first of all, take a look at your compendiums. And secondly, learn the history of the sport. And then join Muskies Inc. to make sure that there's a history of the sport in 25 years. Because without conservation efforts, you and I both know
that the fishery can't stand the pressure that it's getting now if fish weren't being released.
DNRs of all the states are under tremendous pressure financially, sociologically, etc., to do less muskie stocking, not more. If you like muskie fishing, you're going to need to have the representation out there and a voice. And that's one of the things that Muskies Inc., an associated organization of the UC Becker Foundation, etc. That's one of the things that they do. And that's one of the things that Larry Ramsell has done his entire life, is literally spoken the word of muskellunge conservation and truth to the public. So, if you're a new muskie fisherman or an existing muskie fisherman and you haven't taken a look at it, get in there, join, go to the meetings, have some fun, because they are a lot of fun. The activities are a lot of fun. And that money that you put in there will do more than you could possibly imagine to make sure that we've got good muskie fishing well into the future. So there's my pitch.
It's money well spent.
Yeah, I think so.
About the price of a good lure.
Yep, for sure. Well, let's talk about one more thing. I'm in the process of organizing it right now, and I think it's really kind of a neat body of work. Let's talk about your last project that you just finished up with the 11th installment on Muskie First. Talk to me a little bit about how you open that up and what it is.
Well, there's what I call legendary hotspots that have been muskie hotspots since organized muskie fishing began back in the 1800s. And I've been fortunate enough to fish those spots, and I thought, there's a lot of hot spots all over the muskie range. Some of them are well known, some of them aren't, but the truly well known ones are really well known. And for instance, Pete's Bar on the Chippewa Flowage, I can remember back in the 50s and 60s, you had to practically take a number to get in line to get on the bar. And it's a half a mile long. So, you know, wouldn't be unusual to see 30, 40, 50 boats out there in an evening. And somewhere on the bar, somebody was catching a fish. So that became a community hotspot that was, you know, legendary and well-known. And of course, Windmill Point in the St. Lawrence River, Quebec, and the 40-acre shoal is probably one of the most famous for really big fish in the St. Lawrence River, Gananoque, near the mouth of the St. Lawrence River. And, there's probably dozens and dozens of them in Lake of the Woods, but the guys that know those spots really don't want to share. So we were unable to do anything with Lake of the Woods other than, you know, generalizations and the world record fish that have come from there. But ironically, as big as it is, almost 1 million acres, it's never produced a legitimate 60 pounder. You know, there's some rumors and legends from history that fish that size were caught, but there's no validation of them. So here you have one of the top musky fisheries in the world that's not yet produced a 60 pounder. So guess what, folks? There's probably not too many of them swimming around in there. No.
Yes, you know, what we're going to do is put that together so that folks don't have to look too hard for it on Muskie First and get that published in a single document. That's going to be a project because you did a great job. It's lengthy. And the number of reads on that is really amazing. It's thousands and thousands now. So it's of great interest to a lot of people. You know, a lot of them have never heard about these legendary hotspots. A lot of them have, but there's a lot of new folks in the sport. And now they'll understand how it got that way and what it means. So it's again, I thought a really interesting way to preserve that history so it doesn't disappear. Because, you know, a lot of that stuff, as the younger generations take over and guys like you and me move on, those names, et cetera, are going to get lost. And fortunately, now we've perpetuated it. So we'll get that all put together.
They're in print now. They'll be in print, so it'll be available for many years to come.
Yep. And, you know, we've got that. I think what I'm going to do with that is create a section for it so that anytime anybody has any questions, you know, about Lake St. Clair or about Wabagoon or about Georgian Bay or any of the others that you covered, those pieces have the history. It has the pictures of the big fish from the past and present. It has interviews with people from the past that you've done, interviews with people from the future and comments, or from the present rather, and comments. Just an awful lot of information about some of the best muskie fishing spots on the planet. So it's a great resource and something that folks ought to take a look at if they're curious at all about.
And there's a lot more backstories to what I wrote in this series. But you know, I didn't want to write another book, put it on the internet for nothing.
I can't imagine why not, Larry.
But you know, I spent quite a number of hours this winter putting those series together and enjoyed every second of it. I spent a lot of time re-editing just to give me something to do between posting of the series. But it was a lot of fun. But by doing it that way, I was able to make it much clearer and more accurate and plug in some stuff that I'd forgotten about until the light come on. Or this last one that we did, part 11 on Wabagoon, I hadn't intended to do Wabagoon and then thought about it, even though it has a lot of history of big fish. And one of the Muskie First readers emailed me and said, how about Wabagoon? And of course the light went on immediately of what went on back in the late 70s and 80s and on forward. And particularly remember talking to you about getting a tooth through your thumb. And,
yeah. And, that was something.
So I thought, yeah, that would make a good addition to the series. So instead of stopping at 10, we went on to 11. So, and you know, maybe down the road, I just got contacted by an Ontario guide mentioning a spot that he thought I knew about that I didn't know anything about, but it's evidently where hundreds and hundreds of people catch muskies from shore.
Oh, really?
And thought that that should, thought that should be included in the series. So I emailed him back and told him I knew nothing about it, but if he didn't want to do it, if he knew somebody that knew the background of that spot, wanted to write it up, why, we would reinstitute the series and add part 12. So we'll see if he comes through.
Well, that was, I got a big kick out of contributing to your last episode on Wabagoon, because that gave me a chance to tell a story that I've told friends many times that I never had been asked to tell before. And, you know, talking about Hannah and Trevor Northcott and Claybanks Marina and, you know, my kids, just both my sons love to fish. And I took them to Wabagoon because that's where I finally settled after all the years, 20 years, 25 years of driving around Northwestern Ontario. I finally figured out that I could get one there. I knew I wasn't going to get one on Lake of the Woods. It was too big. I had little faith that I would get one out of a lot of the other oligotrophic style lakes up there because of the time involved. It just took too much time. And
exactly. You had to be there almost all season to catch one nice fish.
Right. So I figured out that the goon, because I love flowages and I know how to fish them, and that it was underfished because it's ugly. I mean, the water quite literally was chocolate at that time. It's much better now, but it's still, it's not what people expect. The clay bank, that thing's been imploding.
No, it kind of freaked me out when I first saw it.
Oh boy, you can't see anything. You sure don't. And,
no.
And a lot of the islands that I used to fish around are now just humps out in the lake. That's how fast that's degrading. And, you know, fast being 40 years, but just the same, it's completely changed from what it was. One of the interesting things about that I actually didn't say anything about, I was afraid it would look silly. I found when I first started fishing there that the one thing you never ever did on the goon was wash your hands in the water. And that's something that I do everywhere else, you know, to get pike slime off your hands. You know, wash my hands real quick down in the lake and then back to fishing. And several times someone in the boat would have their bucktail or lure out of the water a foot and be turning around to talk to me, and the dripping water into that chocolate covered water, a 30-inch yep. pike would roar up out of the water and grab the thing. And all he would break loose, right? And I thought, well, what's the difference between that and your fingers going like this in the water? So
exactly.
That was a crazy
way to lose a digit.
That was a crazy place to fish, and I still carry the scar of that tooth through my thumb. That fish's tooth was long enough to stick out about a quarter inch on each side of my thumb. And you know what? I played that fish, battled it with my son. He was 16 at the time. It was the first time he ever said a swear word because I kept trying to hand land it. And at the third time that it broke away from me, and I was trying to bring it in for a fourth, he smacked me on the back of the head with the salmon net we were using back then, and an expletive came out and said, "You're netting all fish." So that was a great story. It took me 10 minutes to get that tooth out. They're kind of serrated and they stick, you know. So I finally got it out and brought it in. And when I got the very poor pictures that we took because the cameras stunk back then, brought that in and gave it to Hannah Northcott with a picture. She had it under the glass at Claybanks Marina until she passed away. So that was kind of fun to be able to tell that story. I appreciate the opportunity. Well, let's talk real quick. We talked real quick. We got a little
Pardon
bit of
me?
Time. The Wisconsin opener's coming. That's coming up in a week or so. What's your forecast, Larry, for the muskie fishing in Wisconsin this year?
Well, I think the opener is going to be gangbusters, and I'll tell you why. As I was in Michigan last week, and the water warmed so fast that it's the same thing here. You said you had 70-degree water temperature yesterday. That's prime temperature. I always like 72 is my go-to number, but we're there. And so fish should be going a little earlier than normal this year, I think.
I do too. I found 67 degree water after that big cold front came through. And that's indicative of the fact that that's what it was. It carried 67, 68 all the way through the rest of the day, even though the air temperature was only 50 and there was no sun penetration. So we're going to have 70 degree water, supposed to be in the mid 70s again today here. We'll have a few couple of days of 60s this week with sunshine. So that'll keep, you know, that sun pounding on that water keeps jacking it up without real cold nights. So
personally, on the north side of the lake where the wind isn't affecting it.
Yep. Yep.
Yeah, I think
what are you going to throw opening day? What's your go-to lure for this year?
I'm getting old. I found that out this week. In fact, I bought some hand weights yesterday. I got to start exercising and get my shoulders back in shape. I'm a surface bait and a bucktail man. And it's easy stuff to throw when you get old and feeble like me. And I still catch nice fish on that stuff. So
yeah,
no need to spend thousands of dollars for new lures. And I got a couple tackle boxes full of stuff now. So
do I.
Stick with the old standbys.
I got a just in case box in my garage. I haven't opened for about 3 years. I've got, I have literally, 700-800 lures at the very least that I haven't looked at from anywhere from 20 years to 2 years. So
I think anybody that's been in the game for 6 months or longer, I could tell you the same story. They got hundreds. That's one of the things that drives me crazy as an author is guys new to the sport, rather than spend $35 to buy a book that tells them the history of their sport, will spend $50 to $100 for new lures like they were popcorn. And there's no magic lure. I'm sorry.
Not one. You know? And if everybody
hypes all the, you get all this hype on new baits, but that's the way merchandising works.
Yeah, well, if it's done right, and I've seen it done right a couple of times, when Dick Pearson was working with his lure, and those things hit the shows, the grinder, etc. It was bizarre the number of people lined up at that booth when that show opened up. And then the Weagle, I've never seen anything like that. And supply was not real good. And the demand was crazy. And there were people pushing each other around to get themselves into line. And it got into near fisticuffs. I had to, because the gentleman that was selling on that particular show was late. And Mr. Katie, tripped over his trailer hitch or something and got to the show late. And I was tasked defending his booth. And it was absolutely insane. I've never seen anything like it. Everybody had to have one of these things. And, Suic makes that bait now, the Weagle, and I still use it. It's a great bait, but it was the hottest bait you could throw for a couple of years. And then just sort of trickled on down to a walk the dog surface bait like the rest of them. It's crazy what happens out there.
Same thing happened with the Fat Bastard. And,
that was nuts.
There
were people lined up all the way around the show and out the door. I mean, from that booth, I've worked with the shows doing their digital marketing for them, and I had to go see. So I walked that line of people through the show all the way out the door. They were just standing at
the
door.
It's crazy. It's crazy.
Waiting to buy one lure. And
the
crazy thing.
You can't make them fast enough.
Right. So now they're in the.
Which is a good thing. They catch fish.
Yep. Well, Larry, this has been a lot of fun. I think we'll announce the subject for the next one. We'll do another one in a couple of weeks. We'll announce the subject for our next podcast and put that out there. I think you and I can debate about that and decide what we need to do for the next one. Then what our intent is to keep the history infused into everything that has happened and does happen so that it doesn't get lost. And we're going to talk about controversial issues. We're going to talk about things that have raised some hackles across the industry. We're going to talk about the sport itself and speak the truth, I guess. A couple of old guys who have the knowledge and capacity and the documentation. We can go ahead and clear up a whole lot of myths and silliness. And at the same time, we're going to have a lot of fun and just talk about what's been happening in the muskie world. Big fish that have been caught. As the season gets going, this is a great time to launch it. As the season gets going and things start to pick up, We'll have plenty of subject matter to talk about. It should be a good time. Last thing I'd like to close on, and then we'll shut her down. What do you think of the border being closed in Canada? I know that it's starting to look like they might open it up late this year with vaccinations going up. But what is that going to do to that fishing? Those fish will not have seen any pressure for 2 years.
It should be crazy.
Lights out, isn't it?
I'm in the hopes that since they've eliminated the mask thing here, if you've had the vaccinations, I'm thinking hopefully that the Canadians will see the light and get an infusion in their economy, because it's costing them a ton of money not to have their border open. So it's going to be a mad rush, I'll tell you that, once they open the border. But hopefully they do it, and you and I can go to Wild Lagoon and catch some more big fish.
Well, that's my plan, and we're going to get in the boat together. We've been threatening to do that since we were both 50. And somehow just I go one way, you go another, and the season's over, and we go, well, we missed another year. Well, we ain't got that many years left, man. We ought to do that.
No.
I love that body of water, and I'd absolutely love to show you everything I know about it. I did some crazy things out there to learn that, and that's the subject of another talk, but love to do it.
Yeah.
All right, Larry, thanks a lot. We'll be talking to you here in about 2 weeks.
All right. Thank you.